Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Imagine a scenario, one that really keeps public health experts on edge. A highly contagious animal virus, it's already causing huge outbreaks in livestock, and then suddenly it develops this terrifying new ability can attack the brain.
Mm.
What fundamentally shifts when a virus, one we mostly know for respiratory illness, starts showing clear signs of neurological impact? How would that kind of change force us to completely rethink, well, everything, our understanding of the risks, and crucially, our whole strategy for protection?
Well, this isn't just hypothetical anymore. This is precisely the concern, the escalating concern around the highly pathogenic avian influenza A, H5N1, clade 2.3.4.4b viruses. These strains, they're already fueling a significant ongoing outbreak in dairy cows across the United States.
Right.
And while the human cases we've seen linked to H5N1, they've largely been mild so far, the really unsettling question is, what if some of these circulating strains actually possess traits that could rapidly, dramatically change that picture, make human infections far more severe?
And that's exactly where today's deep dive takes a critical turn. We're getting into some new, really groundbreaking research that unpacks precisely this. It reveals a specific H5N1 isolate, originally from a cow, actually, with a surprising and, frankly, deeply concerning ability to cause severe, rapidly fatal neurologic disease in a key animal model.
Mm.
So we're not just talking respiratory distress now. It's like a direct assault on the brain.
Exactly.
But before we delve deeper into the alarming specifics of this research, it's really essential we shine a spotlight on the team, the dedicated team whose critical findings are shaping how we understand this evolving threat.
Mm.
Who are the minds behind this work?
Yeah, absolutely. We really celebrate the work of Thomas Tippa, Vignesh Mariepen, Kaylee Sienda, Kimberly Mead-White, Matthew Lewis, Atsushi Okamura, Natalie McCarthy, Ekaterina Eltonova, Shenna S. Leventhal, Trenton Bushmaker, Chad S. Clancy, Emmy DeWitt, Vincent J. Munster, Heinz Feldman, and Kyle Rosenke. They're from the Laboratory of Virology Division of Intramural Research, NIAI, NIH, up in Hamilton, Montana. Their work is significantly advancing our understanding of HPAI-AH5N1 virulence and, what it could all mean.
Okay, so let's set the stage a bit. What exactly is HPAI-AH5N1, and why has it become such an urgent global concern, like, right now?
Right. Well, the highly pathogenic avian influenza AH5N1, specifically what's known as the Goose Guangdong lineage, that's basically a particular ancestral strain they found in geese that first popped up in China back in 1996. Since then, this virus has just been a master of evolution. It's constantly adapting, branching out into 10 main phylogenetic clades. You can think of these clades as sort of distinct genetic families, right? Subgroups, each with slightly different traits and behaviors. And clade 2 has really proven to be the most dominant, the most widespread. Starting around 2005, these HPAI-H5N1 clade 2 viruses began to spread, well, pretty aggressively, across Asia, Europe, Africa, and then eventually they made their way to North and South America.
And it's not just a threat to birds anymore, is it? We've seen this worrying trend, this spillover into mammals.
Absolutely. Since late 2021, these H5N1 clade 2.3.4.4b viruses have been continuously circulating in North America. Huge outbreaks in wild birds, domestic poultry. But what's really alarming is the increasing spillover. The virus jumping from birds into wild mammals. We've documented cases in farmed mink in Spain. That was 2022.
Right.
Arctic foxes, raccoon dogs in Finland, domestic cats in Poland, even marine mammals down across South America. And just recently, a mountain lion was found dead in Montana, also infected with H5N1. It just highlights how broad its impact on mammals can be.
And then things really escalated with the dairy cows. That really caught everyone's attention, didn't it? It almost became a household name.
It really did. In March 2024, HPAI-AH5N1, clade 2.3.4.4b viruses were found in dairy cows and, crucially, in unpasteurized milk across the U.S. Now, as of when this paper came out, 70 human cases of HPAI-AH5N1 had been reported in the United States. These were caused by either the B3.13 genotype from the dairy cows or the D1.1 genotype from birds. And while most human cases have been mild, often just conjunctivitis or, pink eye.
Yeah.
Respiratory symptoms have definitely been described. And in a pretty sobering case up in Canada, a teenage girl actually needed hospitalization for severe respiratory failure. Thankfully, she did recover.
So the main risk for humans getting infected here is mostly occupational, right? For people working closely with these animals.
That's a big part of it, yes. Occupational exposure is common, especially for folks on dairy and poultry farms. But we've also seen severe human cases from exposure to sick and dead birds in just backyard flocks. So the exposure sources aren't strictly limited to large commercial operations. And a really critical point here is that there's clear evidence of mammal-to-mammal transmission happening in some cases. Yet despite all this, the US CDC currently categorizes the overall public health risk for human infection as low.
But the really profound point is that this low risk could change. And it could change very quickly if the virus keeps evolving, picking up new genetic changes. This particular study, it seems, it dives right into that critical gap in our understanding of the virus's virulence, its potential punch.
Precisely. It fills a really crucial knowledge gap.
Okay, so with such a pressing, evolving threat, how did the researchers actually go about investigating these specific H5N1 strains? What was their approach?
Well, they started with a very clear comparative goal. They wanted to assess the virulence, basically, how harmful the virus is of a well-known reference, HPAIA, H5N1, clade 1 virus, that's AVN12032004, or VN123. And they compared this benchmark against three very recent HPAIA H5N1 clade 2.3.4.4b isolates. These newer ones were sourced from, highly relevant situations, one from a cow, one from a mountain lion, and another from mink. The bovine isolate, abovine OHB24OSU3422004, that was obviously of particular interest given the ongoing dairy cow outbreaks.
And they use mouse models for this, right? Which specific strains did they use, and why are those models important here?
That's right. They used two established mouse strains, C57BL6J and BALBC mice. These are pretty standard in virology because we know a lot about how they respond to influenza viruses. It makes them reliable for these kinds of comparative studies. And to mimic how exposure might happen in the real world, they compared two main ways of giving the virus: intranasal, which is like inhaling virus particles, and orogastric, where the virus goes in via a feeding tube, simulating eating or drinking something contaminated.
Right, that orogastric route seems particularly relevant for how it might spread through contaminated milk, for example.
Exactly. It's key for understanding that potential pathway.
So once the mice were exposed, what kind of data were they collecting? What were they measuring to see the impact?
They tracked several key things really meticulously. Daily monitoring for clinical signs, so the visible symptoms of sickness, weight loss, ruffled fur, hunched posture, rapid breathing, that sort of thing. And critically, they watched very closely for neurological signs, tremors, ataxia, that's a loss of coordination, hyperactivity, circling behaviors. They also tracked survival rates for up to 28 days. And then, to understand how the virus was replicating and spreading inside the body, they measured virus titers. That's the amount of virus present in organs like the lung, liver, and brain, and also in the blood. They collected these at the peak of the disease.
So they weren't just watching symptoms. They were digging deeper, looking at what was happening at the cellular level systemically.
Exactly. They use histopathology, which is like doing microscopic forensics on the tissues, looking for any cell damage or changes caused by the virus. They also used immunohistochemistry. That's a technique using special markers to basically light up exactly where the virus parts, its antigens, are located within the brain and lung cells. And to understand the immune response, they did cytokine analysis in brain and lung tissue. Cytokines are like the immune system's alarm signals. They looked at specific pro-inflammatory ones like IL-1, GM-CSF, and MIP-1, which tell you the body's mounting a strong, maybe even overwhelming inflammatory response.
Okay.
And finally, specifically for that bovine isolate, they did low-dose studies to figure out its median lethal dose, the LD50. That tells you how little virus it takes to be fatal to half the animals, giving you a real sense of its potency.
Wow, quite comprehensive. So after all this meticulous work, what did they find? What was the big discovery? This is where the H5N1 story seems to take a really concerning turn.
Yeah, the most impactful result, no question, revolves around that bovine isolate. It showed dramatically enhanced virulence and really an unprecedented ability to invade the brain, what we call neuroinvasion, compared to all the other strains they tested. In the C57BL6J mice, the bovine isolate caused uniform lethality. Didn't matter if it was given intranasally, through the nose, or orogastrically by ingestion.
Uniform lethality.
Yep. Intranasally, mice died by day 4, orogastrically by day 6. This disease progression was significantly faster and more severe than what they saw with the mink, mountain lion, or even that reference VN123 strain.
And those neurological signs you mentioned, that sounds like the really striking and honestly quite terrifying part.
It absolutely is. Crucially, every single C57BL6J mouse given the bovine isolate developed clear, undeniable neurologic signs. We're talking tremors, ataxia, that loss of coordination, again, hyperactivity, circling. This level of neuroinvasion was largely unique to the bovine isolate. Only two of the mountain lion-infected mice showed just minor temporary hyperactivity. It was a really stark contrast. And matching up with these severe neurological signs, the researchers found extremely high virus titers, huge amounts of virus in the brains of those bovine-infected C57BL6J mice, way higher than any other isolate where the brain either had no virus or very low levels. Plus, the bovine isolate showed enhanced replication in other organs too and caused systemic infection. They found significantly higher levels of virus circulating in the blood that's viremia. It shows the virus wasn't just staying put, it was spreading all through the body.
Okay, so we've got high viral loads in the brain, unmistakable neurological symptoms. But here's the really groundbreaking part, the paradox you mentioned earlier. What about the actual damage to the brain tissue itself? That's where things got weird, right?
This was a genuinely perplexing finding, yeah.
Yeah.
And it forces us to sort of rethink how these viruses can cause trouble. Despite those incredibly high viral loads and the clear presence of viral antigen, the virus bits inside the neurons and glial cells in the brain. When they looked at the brain tissue using histopathology, they saw no significant physical tissue damage or inflammation.
No damage. But clear symptoms and virus present.
Exactly. It's not just a fascinating biological puzzle. It really shifts our understanding of how viruses can cause neurological disease. It suggests the neurological signs might not be from direct cell destruction or a big inflammatory attack, but maybe from more subtle neuronal metabolic disturbances. Like, imagine the virus subtly messing with the brain cell's energy systems, causing dysfunction without obvious structural damage. This invisible damage mechanism is a critical new piece of the puzzle.
That's wild.
It is. But it's important to note, while they didn't see the physical damage, the bovine isolate did trigger a significant pro-inflammatory cytokine response in the brain tissue, those elevated IL-1 GM-CSF MIP-110 levels. So the brain's immune system was definitely reacting, even if the structure looked okay.
And you mentioned differences between the mouse strains. Did one turn out to be more useful for studying these neurological effects?
Yes. Interestingly, while the BALBC mice actually died a day earlier from the bovine strain than the C57BL6J mice, it was only the C57BL6J mice that consistently showed those obvious severe neurologic signs. This happened even though both strains had similar amounts of virus in their brains at later stages. So it might be down to different immune responses between the strains, or maybe subtle differences in how the disease progresses overall. Perhaps the BALBC mice just succumbed faster to the respiratory illness before the neurological signs really had a chance to fully develop.
Interesting.
So yeah, the C57BL6J model proved particularly valuable for directly studying this neuroinvasion and neurovirulence.
And let's just circle back to that orogastric route ingesting the virus. How significant was that finding overall?
It was very significant. This study strongly reinforced its importance. It confirmed it as a potent way for the bovine isolate to cause infection, leading to rapid disease and death. This has really direct implications for how this virus might spread in the real world, you know, beyond just respiratory transmission.
Okay, so let's try and pull this all together. What does this all mean for us? For the ongoing H5N1 situation, for how we think about viral threats? What are the big takeaways?
Well, the central implication is pretty stark, really. The increased virulence and the neuroinvasion shown by this specific bovine H5N1 isolate in these mouse models is, frankly, deeply concerning for both animal and public health. It tells us this virus is clearly evolving in ways that could lead to more severe disease. It's a serious wake-up call that the virus isn't static, it's changing.
We saw the virus got into the brain, but the exact mechanism, the how, isn't totally clear yet, right?
That's right. The precise entry points aren't fully nailed down. But the presence of viremia virus in the blood strongly suggests hematogenous spread. Like the virus gets into the bloodstream and then has to somehow cross the blood-brain barrier, that protective shield around the brain. For viruses entering through the nose, like in the intranasal tests, direct spread along cranial nerves. The nerves connecting the nose straight to the brain seems like a very plausible route. And what's really fascinating for the orogastric route, when the virus is swallowed, researchers are looking at these nerve networks in the gut wall, the submucosal and myenteric plexi. These could potentially act as direct neural pathways from the gut right up to the brain. That would be a pretty novel way for a virus like this to cause neuroinvasion. Definitely needs more investigation.
And that paradox you described, the neurological signs without obvious brain lesions.
Yeah.
What's the thinking there? How does that change things?
Yeah, the absence of those clear histological lesions, despite the strong neurological signs and the virus being present, it is really intriguing. It strongly supports the idea that the symptoms might be due to those neuronal metabolic disturbances, not direct cell killing or massive inflammation. This has big implications for diagnosis and maybe even treatment. If doctors are only looking for physical brain damage to confirm neurological H5N1, they might miss cases. It suggests we might need to focus more on functional changes, maybe biochemical markers of neuronal stress. It's an area needing a lot more research.
Now, we often hear about specific genetic mutations making viruses nastier. Did this study find any clues about what might be making this bovine isolate so aggressive and neuroinvasive?
It did, but with an interesting twist. Some mutations that we've previously linked to higher virulence in other H5N1 strains, things like the NA-stalk deletion, NS1 deletion, or that PB2E627K mutation-specific genetic tweaks known to boost disease severity,
Right.
they were actually missing in the recent isolates studied here, including the bovine one. This suggests that other, maybe yet to be defined, molecular markers or perhaps combinations of genetic factors are driving their enhanced virulence in mammals. However, these recent isolates do have mutations in the matrix protein M1 and NS1 that are known to increase virulence in mice. So while some expected flags weren't there, other subtle changes are clearly playing a role. It just highlights how complex viral evolution is and why we need constant surveillance.
And let's hit that orgastric exposure route one more time, because its confirmation here seems incredibly relevant right now.
It is, absolutely. This study really hammers home its importance as a potent exposure route. It gives us a very plausible explanation for infections we're seeing in wild and domestic carnivores, like that mountain lion, who probably get infected by eating infected prey. But critically, it also highlights a potential infection route for other mammals, including humans, including cats from drinking raw, unpasteurized milk from infected dairy cows. That's a major point of concern, this research underscores, emphasizing the public health advice about avoiding unpasteurized dairy.
So these mouse models, even with their slight differences, they're proving to be really invaluable tools in this whole H5N1 situation, aren't they?
Oh, immensely valuable. The C57BL6J and BALBC mice are excellent in vivo, meaning in a living organism screening models. They're just crucial for quickly evaluating potential antiviral drugs, testing different therapies, and checking how well new vaccine candidates work against these emerging H5N1 viruses. And specifically, like we discussed, the C57BL6J model is turning out to be particularly useful for digging into neuroinvasion and the mechanisms behind neurovirulence. They're giving us critical, fast insights that directly help our public health responses and preparedness. So I think the central insight from this deep dive is just unequivocally clear. This highly pathogenic avian influenza AH5N1 bovine isolate, the one actually circulating out there, shows significantly enhanced virulence in these mouse models. It rapidly causes fatal respiratory disease and severe neurologic disease. This unique ability to invade the nervous system, even without causing obvious visible brain damage, really underscores the dynamic, evolving nature of this virus. It shows a concerning potential for unexpected and severe impacts.
So what does this powerful finding really mean for how we respond to the ongoing H5N1 outbreak? And how urgently should we be preparing for potential, maybe even drastic, shifts in how this virus behaves, especially thinking about transmission routes like raw milk? This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this analysis, the best way to support Base by Base is to subscribe or follow in your favorite podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating. It only takes a few seconds, but makes a huge difference in helping others discover the show. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, Base by Base.